at expressing solidarity with Palestinian detainees under hunger strike and demanding the release of Anhar Dik, a Palestinian woman who is expected to give birth in an Israeli jail.
Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails face bad treatment as most of them are detained with no clear charge or trial. Most of the detainees suffer from serious diseases and live in bad health conditions. Amid the medical negligence of the Israeli army, Anhar's is in critical condition as she is expected to give birth in a few days. The international community should be held accountable for the fate of Anhar and her baby.
Anhar is also suffering from pregnancy bipolar depression and afraid for her baby's fate in Israeli prison. The family of the pregnant Palestinian woman jailed by Israel appealed for the international community to set her free to give birth outside prison.
We held this rally to highlight the issue of our Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially Anhar al-Dik, who is going to give birth inside Israeli jails. We call on human rights groups to stand up behind Anhar. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from inhuman Israeli policies. There must be a serious action by the world community.
Eight former Palestinian prisoners gave birth to their children inside the Israeli prisons. Statistics say that out of 39 Palestinian women imprisoned in Israeli jails, 12 are mothers.
This rally aims to send a clear message of solidarity to the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially Anhar al-Dik, who is pregnant and deprived of any medical care. We put the blame on the international community that remains silent in front of these violations against Palestinian detainees.
There are almost 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, including women and children, as well as administrative detainees. Palestinian here demands an end to the Israeli policies and detention against Palestinians, especially pregnant women. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Okay, now let's start the Afghanistan section of this broadcast. The Taliban preparing to unveil a new government in the country after taking almost full control. Taliban official Amirullah Motaghi said the ceremony is being arranged at the presidential palace in capital Kabul. According to local news outlets, an announcement that a new government is imminent. Taliban's top figures, including Supreme Leader Haybatullah Akhundzada, are in Afghanistan. The group seized the capital and rest of the country. In a matter of weeks last month, the U.S. pulled out its remaining troops before the August 31st deadline, ending its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan. Calls are growing in the European Union for the creation of a rapid reaction force, and that after the bloc was recently sidelined by the U.S. in Afghanistan. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell says that the need for more European defense has never been more urgent. Slovenia, that holds the bloc's rotating presidency, says that a rapid response force could consist of 5,000 to 20,000 soldiers. The Slovenian defense minister has called for a new system to allow EU troops dispatched if a majority of member states agree to deployments. Germany has also stressed the need for the EU to become more autonomous.
It is very important that we don't act as an alternative to NATO and the Americans, but to become stronger ourselves.
Well, those remarks came as EU defense ministers met in Slovenia to discuss the fallout of Western forces' rushed pullout from Afghanistan. European Council President Charles Michel says that Brussels relied on Washington for the evacuation of its citizens from Kabul. The bloc, who was not involved when Washington and the Taliban signed a peace deal last year either. In 2007, the European Union established a system of battle groups, but a 1,500-strong contingent has never been deployed due to internal disputes. The British Foreign Secretary is saying that there is a need to engage with the Taliban on Afghanistan.
We are pragmatic and realistic. We don't recognize governments. We will not be recognizing the Taliban, but we do see the need to be able to have direct engagement. Otherwise, we can't provide messages, we can't listen to the response. I think engagement will be important in order to set early tests, and what we'll be judging the Taliban by is their actions, not their words.
Question for the Qatari Foreign Minister.
Dominic Raab made a comment during a joint presser with his Qatari counterpart, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, in Doha. He also stressed the need to hold the Taliban to account on their public pledge of a more inclusive government. The Qatari Foreign Minister also said that his country is in talks with the Taliban to resume operations at the Kabul airport as soon as possible. The airport was damaged as the U.S. and its allies evacuated their last forces from Afghanistan. Russia says it has no intention of mediating negotiations between the Taliban and other political forces in Afghanistan.
We have long urged the Taliban and other ethnic political groups in Afghanistan to negotiate the creation of an inclusive transitional government. Currently, we have no plans for being a mediator at such talks. As far as I know, nobody else has such plans either.
The Russian Foreign Minister says that everyone is interested in agreement between the Taliban and other Afghan ethnic and political groups. Lavrov noted that the Afghan Tajiks are in talks with Taliban leaders in the Panjshir Valley. He hoped that the talks would produce a peaceful solution and that the threats of renewed hostilities would not materialize. The Taliban have urged the opposition group in the Panjshir Valley to lay down their arms as fighting continues over control of the mountainous region. Clashes have erupted between the Taliban and anti-Taliban opposition group of National Resistance Forces in Afghanistan's Panjshir province. The valley is the only region in the country that has not been captured by the Taliban following its takeover of the country.
Despite intense negotiations, the Taliban and the National Resistance Front in Panjshir, headed by Ahmed Massoud, have not reached a peace agreement. As a result, the Taliban launched a major offensive from three directions on the valley of Panjshir on Wednesday night to capture an area that has yet to fall under the group's control. The
Taliban have had some offensive to the Khawak High Pass from the Andarab Valley of Baghla. From our side, there were local forces of Andarab, different districts of Andarab, local forces of Panjshir, as well as the ANSF forces. They have defended very well. They have defeated Taliban on that front. Taliban have lost 40 of their personnel, another 35 of them were wounded. Four armies of Taliban were destroyed, two rangers of Taliban were destroyed, and they did not succeed on their offensive.
In the meantime, the Taliban officials say the resistance in Panjshir cannot succeed because the valley is completely surrounded by the Taliban forces. Therefore, the Taliban want Massoud to surrender without any bloodshed, a demand strongly rejected by the resistance in Panjshir.
We want Massoud to surrender. We are all Muslims and we must not kill each other. Panjshir is surrounded by our forces and we will finally capture the valley. So this is better for Massoud to think about the consequences of resisting against us.
Capturing Panjshir Valley in northern Afghanistan has always been considered a big goal for the Taliban, even during their previous rule over 95% of Afghanistan before their collapse in 2001. Ahmad Shah Massoud resisted against major Taliban offensives on Panjshir and did not allow them to enter the valley even once. Now, it remains to be seen if Ahmad Massoud, the son of the legendary Afghan commander, can follow the footsteps of his father, who is also titled as the Afghan national hero in Afghanistan's constitution. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Now, in the meantime, residents in Kabul are said to be optimistic about their country's situation after the Taliban took almost full control. They say that they have been feeling safe in the city as the number of robberies has decreased over the past few days.
Allah has brought peace. There is free movement day and night. The Emirates is good. Earlier, there were thefts of cell phones, robberies. People would do all that. Now no one can steal. You can walk day and night. No one can loot or harm anyone anymore.
The situation is good, thank God. We are poor, underprivileged people, but we are very happy and very thankful. Brother, there is no theft, there is no brutality. Nobody can oppress anyone anymore.
A real change has come into the city. The environment and peace is good, but there are issues with wages since no one knows who is running the country. People are unemployed and searching for work.
And let's move on with the rest of this news broadcast. Families of 9/11 victims are calling for a probe into whether the FBI lied about or destroyed evidence linking Saudi Arabia to terrorist attacks. The request was made in a letter to Justice Department Inspector Michael Horowitz. It was signed by some 3,500 people. They also criticized the FBI for what they called the repeated mishandling of the missing evidence. The victims' families have repeatedly demanded a fresh review of all documents, particularly into Riyadh's role in the attacks. They're suing the Saudi government in a federal court. Nearly 3,000 people were killed on September 11, 2001, when hijacked airplanes were smashed into World Trade Center towers in New York. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Tourism. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the seventh episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to introduce you a leading hospital in Tehran, the Jam Hospital, and get more acquainted with the facilities of this hospital. Please stay tuned. Tehran, capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is a metropolis with a population of more than 8 million. The second most populous city in the West Asia region, and the 24th most populous city in the world. This metropolis is home to a wide range of tourist attractions and fun places to visit, including parks, palaces, old buildings, and many museums. Among the places well worth seeing in Tehran, we can mention Golestan Palace, Niavaran Museum Palace, the Sadabad Complex, Museum of Ancient Iran, Jamshidiya Park, Tochal Complex, and Bird Garden. In addition to hosting many tourists from all over the world every year, Tehran ranks first in Iran for health tourism and attracting foreign patients. The city of Tehran, as the capital of Iran and a modern city, has many welfare and hospital facilities and is home to some world-class experienced doctors and surgeons. This allows prospective health tourists to have a range of options for receiving medical treatment in this city. Many health tourists travel to Iran and seek medical treatment through facilitator companies. These companies called mentors help patients choose the best medical specialists and treatment centers based on their experience and knowledge. These companies offer various services such as obtaining visas and making travel arrangements, arranging hospital admission, and hiring interpreters and translators so that the treatment process can proceed more smoothly for health tourists. There are many facilitators in Iran, and especially in Tehran, where tourists can easily identify those that have obtained the required license from Iran's Ministry of Health and submit their applications by simply searching the internet. Dear listeners, we shall now learn more about Jam Hospital, one of the leading private hospitals in Tehran. Stay tuned, please. Jam Hospital is one of the oldest hospitals in Tehran, having been established in the early 1970s. This hospital has been set up along with the advancement of medical science and the development of Iranian universities through the cooperation of a group of famous Iranian physicians. Among these doctors, we can mention Professor Hassan Hashemian, Professor Ibrahim Sami, and Dr. Abdullah Ali Khani. The construction of the hospital started in 1968, and its construction and architecture were entrusted to a group of young Iranian engineers. In 1970, the hospital construction was completed with 9,000 square meters of infrastructure, and in 1974, Jam Hospital, which at that time was considered a well-equipped and modern hospital, began to operate. The hospital at that time had 128 beds and 3 advanced operating rooms and was equipped with radiology devices and cardiac equipment. In addition, Jam Hospital was the first private hospital in Tehran at that time to be equipped with a radioisotope facility. Since thyroid disease was very common in Iran at that time, the establishment of this hospital was a great help in treating this illness. Jam Hospital is located in the center of Tehran on Motahari Street, and the access roads are very convenient. This hospital has specialized wards, subspecialized surgery wards, subspecialized clinics, paraclinics, and administrative and logistics units. It also currently has 150 beds, as well as 27 beds in the CCU, ICU, and NICU. In addition, Jam Hospital has 6 active operating rooms ready to serve patients with modern equipment. In the operating rooms of Jam Hospital, thoracic open heart surgery, laparoscopy, neurology, orthopedics, and arthroscopy, obstetrics, general surgery, and cath lab, that is, angiography and angioplasty, are performed 24 hours a day. With the frequent and regular admission of foreign patients in Iran, Jam Hospital was able to obtain a license for its IPD department in the field of health tourism in 2016. The IPD ward of the hospital is a separate unit within the hospital, with all medical staff being fluent in English. Patients are followed up in the hospital for several months after admission to ensure their complete treatment and recovery. In 2018, Jam Hospital provided services to about 700 hospitalized patients and 800 outpatients in the IPD department. Jam Hospital is one of the oldest and most well-known hospitals in Tehran. In 2016, it officially started its work of treating international patients and providing health tourism services by becoming the first hospital to gain the required licenses from the Deputy Minister of Health at a time. Jam Hospital is a specialty acute care hospital. Surgical operations that are usually performed at this hospital include heart surgeries, internal heart surgeries, specialized surgeries for treatment of various types of cancer, general orthopedic surgeries, obstetrics and gynecology, cosmetic surgeries, liver surgeries, endocrine diseases, dentistry, etc. Jam Hospital is one of the most well-equipped and up-to-date hospitals in terms of facilities it offers patients. CT scan radiology equipment, NMR scan, cardiac rehabilitation, and psychotherapy all can be offered to prospective Iranian and foreign patients. Foreign patients mostly go to Jam Hospital for treatment of heart disease, general surgeries, specialized surgeries, treatment of cancer, urological surgeries, chemotherapy, etc. Admission to the International Patient Department or IPD in Jam Hospital can be done in several ways. Patients can either refer to the website where they can search from their own country and receive required information, choose their doctors and the hospital, and so on. There are also facilitator companies that arrange hospital admission for international patients. Dear listeners, for direct communication with the Jam Hospital in Tehran, you can apply through the website of this hospital at http://jamhospital.ir or by calling 00981-841437 or 00981-841407. And get necessary information about the cost of treatment, methods of treatment, medical staff, etc. Jam Hospital is one of the most successful hospitals of its kind in Tehran. It has nearly half a century of experience, outstanding medical expertise, is equipped with the most advanced facilities in the world, offers quality medical services, and really cares for and respects its patients. This has been its recipe for success throughout these years. Dear listeners, that was the 7th episode of our series, Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
We try to get close to whom Imam al-Hussein actually is.
Verily, in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there is a warmth in the hearts of the believers that will never cool off.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sees that the evil system is starting to institutionalize itself.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein. Ya Habibi, Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Imam Zain al-Abidin, his mission is the same mission as the previous imams. What are some of the things that he does in that context. There are a number of things that he does. One of them is that he wrote letters. He wrote letters. And he had these letters distributed amongst people that had ears for them. They would be willing to read this. Imam Zainul Abidin, he didn't have a public pulpit to be able to speak regularly to the masses. He was in Medina, in ways under surveillance, in ways restricted, in ways limited. Although it wasn't too obvious, but he was restricted. He didn't have access, or who would provide a... Even Imam al-Sadiq's time, we hear that he had 2,000 students. These are inaccurate statements. There was no session where in Masjid al-Nabi, Imam al-Sadiq stood and then 2,000 people sat there. Now in Qum, your Bahth Kharij has 1,000 students. We're like, wow, that's a lot of people sitting there. 2,000 sitting there in a class, that's not what happened. They've added up the numbers of people that have been associated or have had association with Imam al-Sadiq and said there's 2,000 students that Imam al-Sadiq had. Never had a public pulpit, especially regularly, to speak to the people. What does he use? The means that are available to him. Write something, tell them, read this, repeat it. Not just one, a number of them. Read it and repeat it. And then the wording of the writing was in such a way that it was appealing. When you start reading, you don't want to put it down. In other words, the artistic touch, the eloquence, the wisdom, it's the truth is appealing. The courage that is found once you read it, you realize, you know, this is someone with guts that's writing this. And you also see the cleverness and the tactfulness of the writer. So all of these lead to the person who gets this to want to repeat it. Otherwise, the imam isn't there. Did you read it? Did you read it? No, he wrote something. When he gives it and he encourages, they read it once. They do want to. A few people hear about it. They want to read it. They read it. Then they start doing it. Abu Hamza al-Thumali, in that one letter that I'm speaking of, he says that the Shia, now this is not the early days where there was only three, after they had the numbers had started to increase, Abu Hamza al-Thumali says that the followers of the Ahlul Bayt would read this. Abu Hamza didn't even get it from the Imam. He came a little later. He says, I found a writing that was attributed to Imam Zain al-Abidin. And he says it's about zuhd. And this is being tactful. I'll explain that a little bit. He says it's about zuhd. And the Shia regularly recited this on Fridays. So that means it had become something. The Shia are reading this. It's not something that the Imam wrote and then nobody's looking at. No, it had developed. The Imam used this. Few compared to the mainstream, but it's like starting a fire. There's a little spark here. There's a little bit of coal that has caught on over there. A few of them together, they're catching on. That's what's happening. He's using this to form the identity of the Shia. The principles that distinguish tashayyuh from non-tashayyuh in that environment are very important. That's how you create identity in a social setting where you're amongst a majority. The way you're going to be able to establish an independent identity, a different identity, if there's reasons for it, which there were plenty of reasons for it, the direction of Islam was moving further and further away from the Islam of the Prophet. So to separate from the mainstream identity and create a distinct identity. The way you do that is to focus on the differences, not the differences that will cause friction, fighting. That's not the objective of it. The objective, sometimes people talk about differences, what they want to do with it or what ends up happening is to cause fighting, conflict. These letters did not create conflict between the people who were forming this identity and the others in terms of arguments, fightings, taking out swords or anything like that. Ideological differences. In other words, the wrongs that they're moving towards, he stresses on, that is wrong, this is right. Out of all the Islamic teachings that we have, what are some of the elements in this ideological identity that the Imam is presenting to his followers and telling them to repeatedly go over, mention, think of, so that this becomes your identity? The Imam, in a few different ways, mentions this. And that's why Abu Hamza al-Thumali says, these writing, or this writing that I found, and he says, by the way, I didn't finish that part, he says, I went to the Imam, I made a copy of it, I went to the Imam, and I said, this is attributed to you. Are these your words? He said, yes, he confirmed. These are my words. Abu Hamza didn't get the title from the Imam. He read it, what came to him, the word that he uses in describing this writing is that it was the most eloquent, best writing, most moving writing compared to anything else that we have heard, except for what we've heard from Ali ibn Abi Talib about what? Zuhd, which means to be disconnected from the dunya, not follow the desires, the lower desires of this material realm, not be a slave of the lower desires and temptation. That's what he calls it. The wording of the Imam, you read that, you think it's about Zuhd, he's probably going to be talking about how bad the dunya is and so on and so forth. But when you read it carefully, you realize that's not the language. This form of Zuhd that we understand, that is apolitical, the type of Zuhd that when is explained is always completed, or they always end the conversation about Zuhd, that Zuhd doesn't mean not to have nice things, not to have big homes, not to have number of cars, not to have good cars, not to have electronics, not to have good clothes, not to have good fragrances, not to... Zuhd doesn't mean any of that. They talk a whole session, 45 minutes, about the Zuhd of Ali ibn Abi Talib, so on and so forth. After 45 minutes, but Zuhd doesn't mean you don't enjoy this. Everybody goes home and they do enjoy everything that they were enjoying anyway. Imam Zain al-Abidin is talking about Zuhd in a context where the rulers of the land, which as we said, the hadith says, "An-nas ala dini mulukihim," the elites in the land are indulging in the dunya. It's all about taking pleasure in whatever they can. And I mean whatever they can, whatever is available. And they create this race. If you're closer to the governor, if you're closer to the ruler, if you're closer to the governor of Medina, you're going to get more. And everybody's looking and seeing. What happens? This race forms. Race towards the dunya. People are moving towards that. Everybody wants that. They want comfort.
Oh,
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight. Between a third and a half of the world's wild tree species are threatened with extinction, posing a risk of wider ecosystem collapse, the most comprehensive global stocktake to date warns. Forest clearance for farming is by far the biggest cause of the die-off, according to the State of the World's Trees report, which was released on Wednesday, 1st of September 2021, along with a call for urgent action to reverse the decline. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Jonathan Watts. The piece is titled, "Up to Half of World's Wild Tree Species Could Be at Risk of Extinction." Please stay with us for more of Jonathan Watts's article. Between a third and a half of the world's wild tree species are threatened with extinction, posing a risk of wider ecosystem collapse, the most comprehensive global stocktake to date warns. Forest clearance for farming is by far the biggest cause of the die-off, according to the State of the World's Trees report, which was released on Wednesday, 1st of September, along with a call for urgent action to reverse the decline. The five-year international study found 17,510 species of trees are threatened, which is twice the number of threatened mammals, birds, and amphibians and reptiles combined. This was 29.9% of the 58,497 known species of trees in the world. But the proportion at risk is likely to be higher, as a further 7.1% were deemed possibly threatened and 21.6% were insufficiently evaluated. Only 41.5% were confirmed as safe. The problem was evident across the globe. Brazil, home to the planet's most diverse forest, the Amazon, had the most, 1,788 threatened tree species, including bigleaf, mahogany, rosewood, and eugenia. In China, the world's sixth most biodiverse nation, magnolia, camellia, and maple were among the 890 species of trees which were at risk. Tropical island states, notably Madagascar, are disproportionately affected, particularly ebony and rosewood. But even in Europe, which is relatively poor in terms of natural diversity, there has been an alarming decline in numbers of white beans and rowan. In North America, pests and diseases are causing severe losses of ash populations. Botanists describe trees as the backbone of the natural ecosystem. Although only 0.2% of species have become extinct so far, the authors say an accelerating decline could have dire knock-on effects. Humans are directly affected by the loss of carbon sequestration, oxygen production, timber for construction, fuel for fires, ingredients for medicine and food, buffers from storms, and the well-being that comes from shade and beauty. Arguably more important are the indirect impacts on the natural life-supporting systems. In many parts of the world, trees are the pillars of a healthy ecosystem. Without them, other plants, insects, birds, and mammals struggle to survive. Trees are essential. It's like a Jenga tower. Pull the wrong one out and the ecosystem falls apart, said the report's lead author, Malin Rivers, the head of conservation prioritization at Botanic Gardens Conservation International, or BGCI. When I look at these numbers, I feel we need to act now, Rivers said. Report identifies the main threats to trees. The leading threat to trees, according to the report, is farming, with crops 29% and livestock 14%. That is followed by logging 27%, housing and other commercial development 13%, fire 13%, mining 9%, pulp plantations 6%, and invasive species 3%. Climate change, 4%, is bottom of the list, though this does not include the pressure it adds on fire and agriculture. Gerard Donnelly, the president of the Morton Arboretum in Illinois, United States, hoped policymakers would use the groundbreaking study as a conservation tool. Gerard Donnelly said, "This report makes clear that the world's trees are in danger. It was developed through years of vigorous research and collaboration among the world's leading tree conservation organizations and will guide further scientifically informed action to prevent tree extinctions." The Botanic Gardens Conservation International, or BGCI, has recommended an expansion of protected area coverage for threatened species of trees. Planting campaigns that focus on the highest risk populations, closer global collaboration, more funding for conservation efforts, and greater efforts to back up species in botanic gardens and seed banks. The group has launched a global tree portal, an online database tracking conservation efforts at the species, country, and global level. For the first time, we know which tree species are threatened, where they are, and how they are threatened, so we can make better informed conservation decisions, Malin Rivers said. Rivers added, "These species are not extinct yet. There is still hope. There are still ways to get them back from the brink."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Why is the uprising of Ashura different from all the uprisings and movements of the world? January 16, 1994. We need to read between the lines and carefully ponder over the life story of Hussein ibn Ali. Many have risen up in the world. They have had a leader and they were also killed. Among them, numerous were children of the prophets and imams. However, Imam Hussein was unique. The event of Karbala was extraordinary. The martyrs of Karbala have a special position. Why? The answer is to be searched in the nature of the event, which gives a lesson to us all, including and maybe in particular to you, dear disabled war veterans. One characteristic of the event is that Imam Hussein's movement was solely and truly for the sake of God, the religion, and rectifying the society of Muslims. This first feature is very important. Imam Hussein stated, "I did not rise up leaving my homeland out of self-interest, for the sake of seeking pleasure, corruption, or oppression." That is, it was not for swaggering, selling himself, desiring something for himself, or a pretentious spectacle. There was not even a bit of oppression or corruption in this movement.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
I rise up only for the sake of rectification of the nation of my grandfather, the Messenger of Allah. This is an extremely important point. The Arabic word used, which means only, indicates that there is no other intention that can contaminate the pure intention and the sun-like mind of Imam Hussein. When addressing the first Muslims of the early years of Islam, the Holy Quran states, "Do not be like those who marched out boastfully to show off their strength to people and hinder people from the way of God." Quran chapter 8, verse 47. Here Imam Hussein says, "I did not rise up out of self-interest or for the sake of seeking pleasure." These are two different manners, two different behaviors. The Quran reads, "Do not be like those who marched out boastfully, arrogantly and selfishly." It means that this kind of behavior lacks the purity of intentions. That is, in the movement of the corrupt approach, it is only self-centeredness that matters, to show off. This kind of a person adorns himself, rides an expensive horse, wears pieces of jewelry, recites arrogant chants, and comes out towards where? Towards the battlefield. The battlefield is where this person and many like him will die.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.